Well, okay, so the four horsemen. This being a series of talks on characters from the Bible, I had to really question Brother Josh on this choice because, as we know, these writers are not real men. Okay, these are symbolic representations of events that happened during the Roman Empire. So I struggled a little bit in trying to figure out what character lesson could I draw out of these four fiction, not fictional, but symbolic representations. And it came to me at one point in time that, well, while these things were going on, our brothers and sisters were still living in the Roman Empire at the time. So I thought, well, maybe what we can do is look at the events. Consider the impact that this may have had upon our brothers and sisters, and then consider what their characters should have been during those times. So that's what I came up with. And obviously the ideas of the explanation of the symbols are pretty much cut and dried, but we're really kind of assuming what our brothers and sisters, what their character might have been during that time. So certainly what I offer is not definitive, and if we want to talk about things, that's fine. But I really do hope to rein this class into one class, okay? That is my intention. All right, so what was the character then of the saints during the periods of the Roman history that is described by the four horsemen? Well, the first thing we need to understand is that the four horsemen were actually each of the horsemen was when the seal was opened, the horseman was revealed. Okay, so four of the seven seals of the apocalypse relate to these four horsemen. Now, the opening of the seals up through the sixth seal were significant in the outworking of the apocalypse. Because what are we looking at when we're looking at the apocalypse? We're looking at the origin and the development, aren't we, of the religious system that stands against the kingdom of God. So the seals then were the events which brought circumstances to such a point that Christianity and the sixth seal had victory over paganism. Okay? So each of these seals were working towards that end, and the four horsemen obviously fit within that. So the first seal beginning with 96, obviously that's the opening of the apocalypse, isn't it? So starting with John on the Isle of Patmos, and he was exiled to Patmos prior to 96 AD. Because in 96 AD there was a change of emperors, and there was actually a change of the general attitude of the Roman Empire at that time. John was put in on Patmos by Domitian prior to 96 AD, but the apocalypse came to him, we believe, around that time, 96 AD. So again, the opening of the apocalypse down through 324 AD, when the church finally gained its position over paganism, and we're probably familiar with much of that. Okay, so each horseman then is revealed with the opening of a seal, and there were seven seals on the scroll of the hand of the one who sits on the throne. We read that in chapters 4 and 5 of the Apocalypse. And Brother Thomas in Eureka, he gives us a wonderful sense, I think, of the scriptural purpose of the unsealing of the scroll. Okay? So I know there's a lot to read here, and I don't know if everybody can read that. If not, you might want to move forward. But Brother Thomas writes in Eureka, "Thus it is obvious that the kingdom promised to the saints could not be established so long as the man of sin power were undeveloped." Okay, we're familiar with that verse in Paul's writing, that the kingdom would not come until the man of sin be revealed, right? Okay, so this is what Brother Thomas is commenting on. And secondly, that the man of sin power could not be manifested upon the scene of the fourth beast habitable. What's he talking about there? He's talking about Daniel chapter 7, verses 7 and 8, with the fourth beast. Okay, we're familiar with that as well. The fourth beast representing the Roman Empire. So the man of sin could not be manifested upon the scene of the Roman Empire so long as the constitution of this beast dominion continued pagan. The former necessity of the situation is thus expressed by Paul: he that now hinders will hinder until he be taken out of the way, and then shall that lawless one be revealed. When Paul wrote these words, the power that hindered the manifestation of the lawless one he described in a previous verse, in whom he styles the man of sin, the son of perdition, was the same power that exiled John to Patmos, the pagan Roman. It was necessary that the pagan Roman power should be taken out of the way. This was an important element in the drama to be performed, but how was it to be accomplished? The answer is by the cumulative force of the events developing in the course of and culminating in the full exhaustion of the things written within and on the outside of the first six seals. This is the first division of the apocalyptic scroll, a six-act tragedy resulting in the fall of paganism and the enthronement of the Laodicean apostasy called by its devotees the Holy Catholic Church as the religion of the Roman state. So we understand what Brother Thomas is saying here, that as long as pagan Rome maintained the upper hand, it would not be possible for the man of sin to be revealed, as that required the foothold of the Catholic Church in the Roman system, in the Roman habitable at that time. And so the horsemen play a symbolic part in the history of the Roman Empire in its transformation from pagan to Christian. In the context, it's appropriate that the horse is used, right? We understand what a horse is, stands for as a symbol of war. And this particular time period in Rome's history was a warfare or combat between the rising Christian church and the established pagan order. And there could only be one victor. So during the time of this ascendancy of the universal church, the true followers of Christ needed to be aware of their circumstances of those turbulent times. And they needed to find a way to stand separate from the growing apostate influence as it prospered towards the goal that was eventually given to it by Constantine. So Constantine at first, or the Roman Empire, made no distinction between the different Christian sects, but obviously there was a marked difference between the true followers of the Lord Jesus Christ and those who had gone out, right? They were not of us, they departed. And Paul also references the idea that the changes in the in Christianity were already afoot in his days, in his times. And that, of course, was the what we refer to as the apostate situation of the. And this was the Christianity that eventually, through some struggles, it wasn't easy. It was a bit of tug of war. But eventually it was that form of Christianity which, having the desire to be politically powerful and influential in the Roman Empire, eventually ascended to that position, being helped greatly by Constantine. The brothers and sisters in that time, they did not have those aspirations to rise up in power and authority in the Roman Empire. Rather, they were concerned with what? With preaching the gospel, right? That was the commission that was given to them. And we understand that too from the Lord's words, that the gospel would be preached throughout the whole world, throughout the Oikumene. That was the commission that he gave them prior to his ascension. Okay, so let's look at the horses then. The white horse. 96, as I said, the beginning of the opening of the apocalypse, to 183. And this was a time of prosperity and peace. And this time, though, was preceded by the reign of Domitian. And that was a time of persecution for the followers of Christ. There was a time of chaos in the empire. Which, you know, if you look at the history, the early history of the empire, I can't imagine any time that wasn't really chaos. But apparently this time period was a time of peace and prosperity. Therefore, the color of the horse is white. Brother Thomas in Eureka, commenting, he says, Gibbon has remarked that were a man called to fix upon an epoch in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was the most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the ascension of Commodus. The vast extent of the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of wisdom and virtue. The armies were restrained, and we'll see why that's important when we look at the Red Horse. The armies were restrained by the firm but gentle hand of four successive emperors whose characters and authority commanded involuntary respect. The forms of the civil administration were carefully preserved by Nerva, Trajan, Adrian, and the two Antonines, who delighted in the image of liberty and were pleased with considering themselves as the accountable ministers of the laws. So at the hand of these emperors, then, what we see is a time of peace because the laws of the empire were apparently being fairly and justly administered. All right, now we are given an indication. We didn't read Revelation chapter 6. You should probably have that open. But the thing that we notice in Revelation chapter 6, one of the outstanding details of the white horse is that the rider has a bow, but no arrows. Okay? And Brother Roberts explains this for us in the 13 lectures. He says, the horse being white would indicate a work of righteousness and peace to which the body politic of Rome was being subjected by the party represented by the rider with the stephan. That's the crown that he's wearing there. Having a bow but no arrow, what party could this be? The apostolic enterprise at once suggests the answer. This enterprise was a conquering enterprise of a certain sort, having the Roman Empire as the arena of its operation. It was an enterprise achieved without bloodshed so far as the aggressions of the apostolic party were concerned. As Paul said, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Again, he said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and powers, that is, the ruling authorities, against spiritual wickedness in high places. The bow is a symbol of speech. The victory was to be won by the use of the tongue, but without arrows as weapons of offense. This was the nature of the war carried on by the Spirit of God through the body of Christ in the days of John. It was a war of ideas, of truth against error, of righteousness against wickedness, therefore fitly represented by an archer without arrows, and an archer wearing the stephan, the token of victory, for the apostolic testimony did in the end vanquish paganism in the Roman state. Now, when we read through Brother Robert's comments, we need to do so and make certain distinctions, okay? Because the victory over paganism wasn't affected by the apostolic application of the words of Christ. Okay, as we might understand, because that's what Paul says. He's talking about the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. Okay, so he's talking about the brotherhood there. That's what Paul is talking about. The weapons that we have are the word of the gospel. And Brother Robert hints at this. He says, it was an enterprise achieved without bloodshed so far as the aggressions of the apostolic party were concerned. Now, that was true of the apostolic party, the true apostolic party. But the apostate, well, not so much. Okay, the apostate through history has been willing to use whatever means it has at hand to accomplish its ends. So we need to kind of make a little distinction here between the true apostolic preaching of the gospel and the aspirations of the Catholic Church, which are different. And it was the Catholic Church, not the apostolic preaching of the gospel, which overcame paganism. But in the eyes of Rome, at this point, it was all kind of one. If you're a Christian, you're a Christian. Okay, and that's how they viewed it. And it wasn't until Constantine made a distinction that it became an important issue. But again, this was a time of peace and prosperity that had followed a time of chaos and persecution. And we understand the persecution, don't we? We can read through the Acts, and we can see all manner of evil that was done upon our brethren. And we can read through profane history, and we can understand what the things that our brethren suffered at the hands of these emperors, okay, as they were trying to squash what they thought was what they perceived, and they were true. It was true. They perceived it as being some sort of challenge to the pagan state that was. Okay, the persecution against Christianity in the eyes of Rome was not so much because of Christianity, but because it wasn't pagan. Right? Okay. So, what is the character then of the saints during this time period? Well, that is determined by the circumstances in which they found themselves. And what they found themselves in was a time of peace and prosperity that had followed a time of chaos and persecution. And so the time of the white horse was not a time for rest. It wasn't a time to be relaxing after the peril that they had experienced. But rather, it was a time for action, because the prevailing atmosphere at that time provided them with an opportunity for preaching against the erroneous philosophies that surrounded them in the world in which they lived. So it wasn't a time for taking a break. It was an opportunity to work. A window of opportunity was opened for them. Now, at the same time, the apostate church is also working and preaching its message of Christianity, slightly different, actually largely different in a number of different ways. So this time was an opportunity for the brothers and sisters to preach the gospel of the coming kingdom of God. So, okay, and again, in our first class on characters, we said that in order to really be valuable, we need to find a way in which to apply the character that we're looking at in the scriptures to our time. So what about us? Well, we live in a time of peace and prosperity, don't we? At least in this country. It's not the same all over the world. But we live in a time of peace and prosperity. And so what should we be doing? Well, we should be utilizing our arrowless bow. Right? And that's what we, God willing, we will be doing this afternoon. And it's important for us to realize as members of this ecclesia that Brother Bob, yes, we'll be speaking, but it is really our effort. We are all involved. I won't be up here speaking. In other words, most of you, only the one. But it is our attempt to spread the gospel in this area. And so we should consider ourselves as participating in that. And a large part of that is supporting the effort. Being here to support the work. And also to support the work in other ways, advertising and speaking with our friends and our acquaintances, trying to get people to come. That's what we're involved with. That's what we should be doing. But we need to understand it within a certain context, because, at least in the context of the white horse, the brothers and sisters in that age were speaking against the erroneous philosophies of their day. Also, so should we. Now, we do preach the good news of the kingdom, but we know that there are many erroneous philosophies in our society that we need to draw a distinction between. And I believe this afternoon we will hear that very thing. But there is an attitude that is rampant in our world, which is humanism, and that's something that we really need to make a stand against while we have the opportunity. because we do live free of persecution. Moving along to the red horse. Okay, 183 to 211 AD. Now this was a time of, this was a period of bloodshed. That's why the horse is red. It's the blood. Emperors were violently removed, and the rebellious crowds were dealt with unmercifully. Now, in verse 4 of chapter 6, we read about a great sword. And that Brother Thomas translates that as a great dagger. And so it's different than the sword that we see in verse 8. The one in verse 8 is a weapon of war. The dagger, or the great sword in verse 4 is used quite differently. It was an instrument of assassination. So what you see there, that picture, that's actually a Roman dagger. It's not a sword. That was a one-handed item. Okay. I found a PBS article about the Roman Empire, and this is what they had to say about this time period. It says, emperors had no elections or term limits, no early retirement or pension plans. It was a job for life. So if an emperor was mad, bad, or dangerous, the only solution was to cut that life short. And that's what we find in the time period of the Red Horse. It was the motive behind the violence was a dissatisfaction with the way things were, and an effort to change things, a desire for change. Everyone had different ideas about the established order. And so change of order came quickly, and it came often. It really was a bad time to be in politics in Rome. The first emperor, Commodus, he reigned 15 years, and he was strangled in the bathtub in his own palace. Pertinax, who followed after him, 86 days, and he was murdered by his own guard. I remember I said in the white horse that the army was being restrained. Well, in the red horse, no, that's not the case. So Pertinax was slain by his own soldiers. Julianus, a mere 65 days, and he was executed the orders of the Senate. This next gentleman, he's very interesting, Caracalla. He reigned actually 19 years, but he co-reigned with his brother, Quita, who's not coming up for some reason. Here he comes. So Caracalla and Quita reigned together for 2 years and 10 months, and then Caracalla had his brother killed. 19 years after Caracalla began, he was murdered by a soldier. Macrinus was, after a year and 58 days, was killed during a mutiny. Elagabalus, the successor, a little bit longer, three years, 9 months. He also was murdered by the Praetorian Guard. And then the last emperor of this period, Alexander Severus, 13 years, and he too was assassinated by the army, by his soldiers. Okay, and if you read the history of this time period, it wasn't just the bloody demise of these emperors, but in each case there was an uprising. So it wasn't like, you know, just somebody get this great idea, I'll go kill the emperor and somebody else can be emperor. Everyone was rising up themselves, okay, and leading these rebellions, which culminated in the death of the emperor, but also many people would die during these rebellions. Because the emperors were quite severe. And there were many in the army who were loyal to the emperor at all costs, even though obviously there were some who were not. I mean, this doesn't represent, you know, when he was murdered by the Praetorian Guard. That's not everybody. That's just those who had the drive to go to that extent. So verse 4 of Revelation 6 tells us that the red horse, the rider of the red horse, takes away peace from the earth, effectively undoing the work of the first horse. So that period of Christianity's prosperity in its quest to conquer paganism came to an abrupt end. And the red horse period marked a need for a different attitude in the believer's life. At this stage of the Roman Empire, the true believers needed to stand apart. They could not find themselves entangled in these uprisings as citizens, okay? Or in regard to the universal church, who was still doing its work, still had its desire to become influential, but a lot of that was curtailed in these days because it was incredibly dangerous. Right? So this is the red horse. So what do we learn then about character of the saints during the period of the red horse? Well, the thought that came to me, it's a warning to let the world carry on in its headlong rush to its own destruction. We're not to get entangled in that. We're not to stand up for Pertinax. We're not to make a plea for Gaeta. Okay? So when we look about us in the affairs of this world, and we see the men who are modern contemporaries of these emperors doing their thing, if you will, we're not to take sides. It doesn't matter whether we think, the current White House is foolish or courageous. It doesn't matter. We're not to take sides. We're not to become entangled in the things of this world. Because the world is governed by the godless mind of the animal and driven by these passions, okay, it gets itself into situations that are not proper for the saints to be involved in. We need to stand apart. Now, we're familiar with the story of Lot. And we're familiar how at the beginning he cast his eyes and looked upon the plains, right, of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was desired unto him. And so he pitched his tent towards Sodom, right? And then later on we find that, well, he had actually moved into Sodom. Because when the ten kings came and took that city captive, Lot was part of that captivity. And Abraham, by the hand of God, delivered him. But when the two angels come, where is Lot? He's sitting in the gate. And we know what that means. That is, he was involved in the affairs of that city. Undoubtedly, his desire was to change that city. But it's not our place to change society. Our place is to change the hearts and minds of individuals within that society. We can't change this world. We see all the things that, by God's estimation, are abhorrent. But we're not going to change those attitudes in society at large. We're looking for the ear that is open to the gospel, the heart and mind that is searching for something that this life just doesn't give. But we cannot become entangled in the affairs of this world. It's a time of madness, chaos, and bloodshed. And the saints of God stand apart from such calamities. And the winds of change in our times are a bit different. It's less bloody than it was then. But it's no less deadly to the saints, to the called out ones. Again, we cannot change the society in which we live, and so we should not try. We make a stand, absolutely. We try to preserve our house, this household, absolutely. We reach out to the individuals. You're planting the seed, absolutely. But we're not going to partake. We're not going to become part of the board of selectmen or whatever it is in this town in order to affect some sort of change. We cannot become entangled in that manner. The Black Horse, 212 to 235 A.D. The black is a color of mourning and distress. But what we notice about, or what we're told about this particular rider, and you can't see it too well. I don't know if I can even point it out to you.
Yeah. You see right here? See how that light is blinking right there?
Anyway, he's holding a balance in his hand. It's not really clear in that picture. All right. What's interesting about that is that Greek word that's translated balance there, that's the only time it's translated balance. Every other time, which is five times, it's translated as yoke. It is a word that is used to indicate something of absolute dependence, as in a legal system that is binding. And so Paul uses that word in Galatians 5, verse 1. He says, "Be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage." It's the same Greek word. Now, Brother Thomas gives us his estimation of this word in Revelation 6, and that it indicates a system of injustice that was binding upon the people of the Black Horse period. He wrote in Eureka, "Among the Greeks and Latins, as also among the moderns, a balance was the symbol of justice, and the hand of an official and indicated a judge or an administrator of justice, or properly of law, which in the mouth of a judge is oftentimes far removed from justice." And we certainly see that nowadays, don't we? "In this seal, it is the symbol of agents whose office was to execute the laws, the imperial functionaries of the empire, both the emperors and their subordinates." So it is a symbol of justice, if it is in the hands of a just man. But in this time period, that is certainly not the case. But we're not left to wonder about the nature of the injustice that the people of the Black Horse period suffered under, to the extent of such distress and mourning. Because along with the balance, there is a voice. And in verse 6, that voice speaks of wheat and barley. And these are used to express the nature of the injustice of the times. Now, Brother Thomas renders the words in verse 6 as a conix of wheat, a denarius. Three conixes of barley, a denarius. So conix, it's interesting. This is a Greek word that is used for a modest measure of grain that will support a man for one day. And by removing the word "for," because it doesn't say a conix of wheat for a denarius. Brother Thomas says a conix of wheat, a denarius. By removing the word "for," Brother Thomas suggests that the denarius was a price that was added to the cost of the wheat and the barley. Of course, of which he means a tax. And so this is the nature of the yoke that is applied in the Black Horse period. So do we see a balance, or do we see a yoke? It was a time of great injustice, brothers and sisters. A time of gross taxation. And when you read the history of that time period, you know why this taxation was being taken. It's because the emperor was trying to raise the salaries of his army, obviously to keep them from rebelling against him. So what was happening is the safety and the authority of the emperors was being secured upon the backs of the common man. He was bearing the burden of the empire. Now, we're familiar with the taxation. We don't like the taxes that we have to pay in this country. But it's nothing like what the Romans exacted. We're familiar with the taxation that led to much of the rebellion in Judah, right, prior to AD 70. That was much of the reason for the discontent of the Jews, was the manner in which they were being taxed by the Romans. And here, this is turned upon the Roman Empire at large. And so everyone was bearing this burden. And it must have been incredibly heavy in order for the horse to be black, denoting, again, the mourning in distress of the times. So Gibbon, might be familiar with his history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Well, he wrote concerning one emperor at this time. He said, "The most wealthy families were ruined by partial fines and confiscations, and the great body of his subjects oppressed by ingenious and aggravated taxes." Okay, so the most wealthy families were ruined by taxation. And again, the reason for this taxation was the emperor's careless extravagance being lavished on his military. All right, so if this black horse is about the injustice that was being imposed upon the common man to bear the weight for the emperor and his cronies, and what are we to learn from this? Well, it's very, very simple, brothers and sisters. We should not seek justice in this world because we won't find it. It doesn't exist. So the temptation to stand against one form of abuse or another, it's inherent in our nature, isn't it? Save the whales. Stand up against bullying. Protect the rights of the oppressed. Feed the hungry. House the homeless. Well, that list goes on and on in our society. There's no end to it. And as harmless as an effort might be in this world, and no matter how noble that cause might seem, the godless thinking of the human animal will inevitably entangle the saint beyond their original desire to help the helpless. Again, it is a matter of becoming entangled in the things of this world, because good intentions are nearly always corrupted by human nature. Injustice in our society has taken on a guise of righteousness whose motives are opposite of the righteousness of Yahweh. There's a phrase for it in our world. It's political correctness. It's an aspect of humanism that preys upon our good nature and our desire to help our fellow man. But unfortunately, again, good intentions are corrupted by human nature. And we see what happens in a great many of these so-called good intentions or good works being done to save this or save that or spare this or spare that. A lot of times, in the end, what we find is that the organization is corrupt. And the money hasn't gone to the effort that was expressed. The money goes to fill somebody's pockets. That's corruption. And as tempting as it might be, we need to be very, very careful where we make our alliances in this world. Because justice in the form of human rights in this society demands an acceptance of many attitudes that are contrary to Scripture's teaching. Pale Horse, 235 to 303. Now, the word for pale there in the Greek is chloros, and it means the greenish hue of death. And we're familiar with like chloroform, or what is the, what do the trees do? Chlorophyll. Yeah, I mean, there's a greenness, right? We're familiar with that. But in this case, it's actually speaking of death. Now, we find from the scripture that this affects the fourth part. Okay, and this refers to the fact that in this time, the empire, here we go, was actually divided into four districts, with the Italia district being where Rome was situated. That was the focus of the operations of the rider of the pale horse. And this was a time period whose affairs were very, very similar to the time period of the red horse. Brother Thomas comments, in the first 50 years of the period of this seal, keep that in mind, 50 years, there were 39 claiming to be emperors, and all of them died by violence. So 50 years, 39 emperors, all of which died by violence. So what distinguishes then this horse from the red horse? Because it seems to be very similar. Well, Brother Thomas sums it up. He says the fourth beast empire, we've already determined that from Daniel chapter 7, originated with the city of Romulus in its Italian territory as the brain and heart of the future dominion. In order then to affect the body politic with a mortal lethargy, as represented by the deadly pallor of the horse ridden by death, it was necessary morbidly to affect the vital organs of the state located in the original fourth of the earth, or Italian prefecture. So long as this retained its vigor, dissolution would be deferred. Men do not die till the brain and heart have been stricken fatally by disease. The purpose of the deity was to take political paganism out of the way, that the man of sin power, which the Lamb and his followers are to have the honor of destroying, might be revealed. The time had come, therefore, after the death of Alexander Severus, to begin the work of exhausting the seat of the pagan power of its vitality, that it might be paralyzed in all its members, and be prepared for the consummating events of the sixth seal, and the development of which political paganism in Rome should be dethroned or cast out of heaven. Okay, I'm losing my wind. I'm losing my voice. But we will soldier on. So this is a time period of, while the time of the red horse was a time of blood, right? And the emperors, it was a time of rebellion. It wasn't just the blood of the emperors, it was the blood of the people as well. But this was accelerated. This was a time period where death in the political arena was being accelerated to the point where 39 emperors in 50 years all died in a manner that was horrific. Now, in order to understand the pale horse, we kind of have to look at what came after the pale horse. Because after the pale horse, at the end of that period, there was a major shift in the empire. In 303, Diocletian Augustus unleashed his persecution on Christianity, a time that is referred to as the empire's last, largest, and bloodiest official persecution of Christianity. And this is what encompasses the fifth seal. Okay? It was a time of great persecution against Christianity. Now, there's a number of different reasons for this shift in intolerance for Christianity, where there seemed to have been a growing tolerance. All of a sudden, there was this intolerance. And key among the causes for this change was the perception that Christianity was in direct competition with the long-established pagan cults. So basically, the empire is waking up to the fact that this Christianity thing is not going away. It is growing. It's becoming more vocal. And as we shall see, it's becoming more involved. And so paganism, in a last-ditch effort, tries to wipe out Christianity. The hand of Diocletian. The empire's last, largest, and bloodiest official persecution of Christianity. During the time of the Pale Horse, when the pagan Rome was suffering such turmoil and chaos and upheaval, during the time of that Pale Horse, Christianity, as it was organized under the apostate system, was given a bit of rest from persecution. And Christianity, again, in the apostate system, began to flourish, where it no longer lingered in the shadows. Large churches became prominent in major cities throughout the empire. And these were testament to the measure of affluence that Christianity had gained under certain emperors. Of course, the emperors were more focused on what was going on in Rome at that time. Their attention, the empire's attention was turned to that. And so the apostate system took advantage of the opportunity and began to play its hand here and there throughout the empire. Christians began to reach high ranks in the Roman government and in its military, but not yet being officially sanctioned, this change in Christianity's fortunes began to arouse suspicion and actually envy in the hearts and the minds of those who in Rome were the traditionalists. Okay, the old school, that's what we call it nowadays, right? Old school. The old school Romans, they became suspicious of what was going on. They know what's going on in Rome. They saw all that. Meanwhile, hey, what's going on over here? What are these Christians doing? Why are they so involved in our government, our military, our affairs, our townspeople, right? It became suspicion. It became suspicious and envious. And so these traditionalists, these philosophers, their words began to be listened to. And eventually, a resentment for a religious sect whose primary character was being depicted as a God-man, well, this took a violent and tragic turn. Diocletian, at first, seemed to be somewhat tolerant. He began a systematic program of persecution against the Christians to eliminate them from influential positions and to remove their interference with the pagan cultists. So they got them out of the government, out of the military, burned down their churches. And this persecution decimated the ranks of the Christians until the rise of Constantine. And he took the advice of his father. His father saw that the Christians were not going away, and he recognized the political value of these people. And so in 316, Constantine began to elevate the Roman church to a position of lofty dominance over its enemies, over its rivals. And key among the rivals of that Roman church were our brothers and sisters. And so Constantine essentially gave the reins to the Roman church. And any other sect of Christianity suffered at that time. And eventually, in 324, we see Christianity gaining victory over paganism. Remember the sixth seal? Remember that slide? Sixth seal, seal number one, seal number six, victory over paganism. That's what these things were all about. All right, so What about the true followers of Christ during the pale horse? Well, the true followers of Christ needed to stand apart from the rising affluence and influence of the Roman church. The temptation would be to say, well, these guys are doing pretty good. Maybe they have something. But we know that doctrinally, that's not the case. The Roman church became entangled in the affairs of Rome. The Roman church sought a measure of manner of influence in the culture of Rome. And that system entangled itself so that it couldn't be separated from the Roman. The Roman Catholic system was as much of Rome as was its emperors, as was its Senate, as was its laws, as went the Roman Empire, better went the Roman Church, because they gained the upper hand. And this is what the six seals are all about. And the four horsemen were the first four seals. So Rome, the apostate church entangled itself. Again, that seems to be a common thread to these lessons here. But they entangled themselves in the system in a manner that was not in line with the teaching of Christ or the future that he predicted for those who would be his followers. We know these words from John 15. If the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If ye were of this world, the world would love his own. If we were entangled in this world, we would be accepted by this world. But because ye are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. And so I do believe that, you know, looking back in the tunnel of history, so to speak, looking back to these times, in understanding what the Spirit is trying to tell us about these times, we can make certain summations. Summations. Thank you. Okay. About the fate of our brothers and sisters in those days. And knowing the teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ, we can see then, or I don't want to use the word assume, but we know how they were to stand apart from what was going on around them in that time. Because Christianity as a whole was making leaps and bounds of progress in the society in which they existed. But Christ says for us, it is not so. It is not so. It wasn't then, and it isn't now. We are to stand apart. We are not to become entangled, and not try to fix society, not take sides. We stand apart for the express purpose that the true message of Christ be preserved and be shared with individuals who God brings to us, those men and women who have eyes to see and ears to hear.